Welcome to the Sword of Damocles podcast, the hotspot for academic discussions on contemporary research in international security. I'm Jordan Cohen, and here with Courtney Kaiser. We are two political science PhD students at George Mason University. Hey, Courtney, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great. So in this podcast, we will begin by touching on a few news stories and then delve deeply into contemporary academic discussions related to security, international relations, and comparative politics. So the first news story, and the biggest, is that yesterday, at least as we're recording this yesterday, it was released that Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un are in the process of making an agreement to meet and discuss diplomacy regarding to North Korean denuclearization, and the goal is to have this done by May. So today's podcast is going to talk a lot about domestic politics and their effect on IR. So Courtney, I guess the first question is this real? Is this really possible with Donald Trump?
I don't know. I'm kind of looking forward to seeing how this develops, or dreading seeing how it develops, to be honest. I think May is coming up pretty quick for what seems to be a dramatic change in U.S. policy regarding North Korea. There's been a lot of talk about whether or not he agreed too quickly to meet with North Korean leaders, but I think it's been building between North Korea and South Korea for about a month now.
Yeah, and so the biggest concern I have is that the Trump administration is going to take this policy change on North Korea's part as evidence of its bluffing working. And I say bluffing because the cost to what Donald Trump was advocating for in terms of a bloody nose strike and then willingness to wage a war is insane. According to the Pentagon, they're saying a war with North Korea could cost 10,000 American soldiers' lives right up front, not considering the people on the DMZ. And as arrogant as Trump is, I think he recognizes that. So do you kind of agree with that? The risk of accepting bluffing is working.
I think this has the potential to be incredibly negative if talks fall through, and I think that there will be tremendous pressure on the Trump administration not to allow that to happen.
So what then happens in these talks?
I think that'll be the key when this actually happens, and I'm not necessarily an expert on North Korea per se, but I think it'll depend on how well Trump prepares, what winds up being the talking points that they've decided. I think they've come out and said that they haven't agreed to negotiations, but they've agreed to talks, which seems like a distinction without a true difference, if you ask me.
Yeah, I agree with that. My concern comes when we talk about the costs of bluffing in foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And if Trump really believes this is a signal of bluffing working versus North Korea seeing that the U.S. can't back its claims and then agreeing to negotiations where both sides leave happy. Denuclearization is very far. It's an extreme.
Yeah, agreed. I honestly don't think denuclearization would be a result of what winds up happening in these talks. I don't think that it can be at this point. And again, deterrence is a giant game of chicken. So,
but deterrence and this idea of mutually assured destruction only work if both sides have nuclear weapons, which they do, with the ability to actually have a second strike.
Mm-hmm. I don't think the mad doctrine perfectly applies to what we see between the U.S. and North Korea.
Because no, it
I don't think there is mutually assured destruction between the two just because of the difference in capacity between the two states.
Yeah, and I agree. And there's very limited evidence suggesting that North Korea has close to a second strike capability. So what does Donald Trump do with that? Is this any president handles it more or less the same way? Do we see something unique?
Again, I think it'll come down to whether or not Donald Trump sticks to talking points or if he goes back and says something ridiculous on Twitter in the lead up to this that kind of blows it out of the water.
Does Twitter have that effect?
I think in the past we've seen that Trump has kind of shot the administration line in the foot from time to time with his Twitter feed, kind of making policy on the fly there, and then left people scrambling to catch up. And I think when dealing with something as sensitive as this, with the potential damage that we might see, that could wind up backfiring, I think, tremendously.
Well, and so this is the problem with the political science literature has pointed out, is that if diplomacy fails, and Victor Cha has an op-ed in the New York Times about this, but if diplomacy fails, then you're left really with one option, which is war.
Speaking of Victor Cha, we still don't have an ambassador in South Korea, so...
Yeah.
Kind of showing where Trump's priorities are.
Exactly. Diplomacy. Okay, so let's switch. You want to talk about Russia.
Yes, I always want to talk about Russia. So Russia is having elections in 9 days, which kind of seems to have fallen off of the radar, and I think that's largely due to the fact that the results aren't particularly in question. I think at this point in time, Vladimir Putin is polling at 69.5%, with his competition from the Communists and the Liberal Democratic Party trailing behind at 7.5% and 5.3% respectively. Kristina Sobchak, who stepped in kind of in the same place as Alexander Navalny, since he was banned from running, is polling at like less than 1%, I believe. And so kind of in the lead up to the election, like you kind of know the results of this one and how it's going to turn out. I think the major question comes back to what turnout is going to be like. And Putin does have exceptionally high approval ratings. As of November 2017, he was polling at 81%, according to Levada. The population was more so split on Medvedev, with 44% approving and 55% disapproving him, of the prime minister of Russia, that is. And the approval of the activities of the Russian government, interestingly, were also split, with 42% approving and 56% disapproving, which is kind of reflected in the predicted poll amounts. I think Putin and the Kremlin have come out with wanting about 70% voter turnout, and they're looking more so in the 50s, low 60s. As kind of projected for that.
Yeah, so this does have a foreign policy effect, and Putin's trying to mobilize it, right?
Yeah. His March 1st speech, which the news kind of monopolized his talk on Russia's new nuclear weapons, but the whole first part of that speech was more so about economics and Russian social policy, which I think was definitely a move to try to motivate his base to a large degree.
Yeah. And so we talked about missile defense in that speech, and by we, I mean Putin.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of one of those times where it really feels like deterrence, as we just talked about, is working as it should.
Mm-hmm. Or that it might, I think there were a lot of fears that it might kick off an arms race because they have some that we can't track or we can't shoot down, which then spurs us to try to develop competitory technologies, whether or not Russia actually has these in operation or not.
So what's interesting to me and what makes me think there's more to the story here is that missile defense doesn't work, and it doesn't work because there are just really, really, really cheap solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of the most common solution is you have your ICBM. And in the ICBM, you have your nuclear warhead. And if you just launch that out into space with one thing, it could be intercepted by a kill vehicle. That's where Putin's kind of new defense against missile defense technology comes in. But the problem is that if that nuclear warhead is launched with surrounded by dozens and dozens of balloons, when it gets to space, they could inflate those balloons in space and heat them to different temperatures. And missile defense cannot detect, because of the material of the balloon, where the warhead is.
Yeah.
And so at that point, defense is just so much cheaper than offense and being able to counter it that, to me, it doesn't make sense that this statement by Putin is done as a way to say we can counter U.S. missile defense. But maybe as a way to mobilize the population?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that should be seen as the main focus of a lot of things that the Kremlin does. On one hand, they're trying to posture toward the West. On the other hand, they're trying to kind of spur the Russian populace into having pride in the Russian government once again. And that is very closely related to Putin's own popularity and approval of the Kremlin more generally.
Yeah, and so I think that's really interesting in the sense that here we're seeing very much the intersection of domestic politics and international security, where Putin is making international security statements
for the purposes of domestic politics.
Yeah, exactly. So with that, you kind of want to get into our articles of the week.
Yes.
So just to clarify, kind of one of the big things we're going to do in this podcast that's a little unique is we're going to go over recent research in international security and international relations. And so the first article we're talking about is from the 2018 spring issue of Security Studies, Vipin Rang and Paul Stanlands, Democratic Accountability and Foreign Security Policy.
Yeah. So this article was really interesting. I really enjoyed having the time to, well, not really the time, making the time to read it. and in this, they kind of outline two axes that you can look at how politicians care about domestic policy and how that translates to the creation of foreign policy and how important it is to politicians to be careful with what they say about foreign policy and how important it is to those politicians. And like on one side, there's salience, so how important this issue is to the public. And then on the other, how clear it is for people to draw
to differentiate yeah. between policies.
Yeah, and how clear it is the lines of responsibility. Like, can they go back and punish the politicians that made bad policy or did something that they didn't want? Is that clear to people? And kind of splitting it up across these, there when issues have high salience and high clarity, there's high responsiveness to things that happen in foreign policy. There are high constraints. Oftentimes, they critique scholars as taking this as the given in international relations and domestic politics, that this is what we should see. And interests and resources are very carefully regulated, and politicians will be punished. This is where you see politicians being most effective, theoretically, when they're crisis bargaining. Politicians have their hands tied, essentially, by the public, and that is visible to outsiders.
Well, and they also note here that this is the area where leaders are investing just significant amounts of time on these issues.
Yeah, definitely. And so their cases for this are cross-border terrorism from Pakistan and China in the 1960s to 1965, with the prime minister focusing on it because of the cost of failure domestically. And they kind of went through how basically every Indian prime minister focused on this and was not always successful, but they still devoted that focus to those events happening on the border.
Yeah, and I thought this case study really kind of made sense in a lot of ways, because Pakistan or terrorism on the Pakistan-India border is historically and even today just a very important issue to people in India. And at the same time, it's an issue where the government, it's very clear what government policy is and where the dividing lines are.
Yeah, and also as like we continue to go through these four kind of arrangements, I think that the fact that they use India consistently across all four builds a very strong internal validity, that there is this variation across Indian policies depending on how salient the issue is and how clear the lines of responsibility are for leaders. Kind of moving on to the second one, they call this bounded flexibility, wherein there's low salience but high clarity. So the population knows how to punish politicians if they take a wrong step, but the populace doesn't necessarily afford importance to what is going on in foreign policy. So usually politicians have some degree of freedom with the policies that they make, and they have a little bit of freedom to make mistakes, provided that mistake is not too big, because that can move it back into the high responsiveness category and politicians can then be punished, because again, the lines of accountability are still clear.
So I don't buy this one.
No?
I don't think there is a world in which people care about foreign policy and know exactly what's going on in foreign policy, but at the same time don't feel these issues are of primary importance. And I know that they use this case study of China in the late 1940s.
Yeah. So I think part of it is not necessarily that people know what's going on with foreign policy, but they'll notice if something goes horribly wrong and that'll bring it back into salience. But when it has low salience, they aren't following the topic, which is what gives politicians that kind of freedom to maneuver more so on policy that might not be what the population would want if they were clear on the information.
I just don't see how they're getting there, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't see many issues that the public doesn't care about, or many even bureaucracies that deal with foreign policy where the public doesn't really care on most of the issues they do, but when they fuck up, the public knows.
Well, I mean, I think kind of like going back to American case, because it's easier to kind of relate to, I think, for other Americans. I think with American war efforts, we kind of see that, where things will kind of disappear from the news, but as soon as there's a crisis, it'll pop back up again, and then the public will be paying attention to it. Whether or not they can actually punish politicians for what happens in American wars is still up for debate.
Right, and the other problem is that generally when wars happen, mm-hmm. even if they're clearly mistakes, the public supports.
Yeah, that is true. Like, even if there is a mistake, whether or not they'll blame the government for that, or if they'll blame the other side of the conflict. And I would imagine that would be much more the case, but it's not necessarily covered in this framework.
Right. And I think this kind of gets to one of the problems they have. All while being a benefit is there is really strong internal validity here.
Mm-hmm.
They nailed the India and China cases very, very well.
Yeah.
But I almost wonder to what degree and in what situations is that validity external. And I think something for future research would be to pick one of these and say this doesn't exist in certain types of regimes,
etc. Well, I think bounded flexibility might be the one that's the most difficult to map onto other countries. I think in the other cases are, I think, much more common. And even with this case for bounded flexibility, I think some things of it, the danger is always that it's going to become a high salience issue. And I almost wonder, the longer it remains of low salience, I think the less clear it becomes. And I think it loses that clarity over time, just because people aren't paying attention to it and they might not know who to blame and what to look for.
Yeah, I agree with that. So let's keep going down.
Okay. The next one is protected politicians, which is when things are of high salience but low clarity. So politicians invest in foreign policy, but there's a diffuse and complex policy-making apparatus. So the public can't punish or reward politicians. And oftentimes this can lead to little central leadership and policymaking and muddled and incoherent policies that are really prone to demagoguery and opportunism and buck passing, because, of course.
Yeah. And this is really kind of the foreign policy environment we see the U.S. in right now.
Yeah. I think a lot of countries wind up in this category just because of the nature of bureaucracies and kind of the decision-making apparatus. And also, most countries have legislatures that operate in a way where they're beholden to districts but then are crafting national policy, and that naturally confuses those lines of accountability.
Yeah. And this idea, again, just kind of focusing on the U.S., but to start at the intro, they actually note that there is kind of this idea when we analyze foreign policy that we're really just analyzing these high responsiveness bureaucracies and regimes. And in reality, there's these other three types that are fairly common. And I actually buy that. And I think it's because I feel that in most countries, especially the U.S., foreign policy is of high salience, but people don't really kind of know what's going on. And you really are seeing that right now, and your point on Congress is so true. So Helen Peephouse have an article from, I believe, 2000, where they talk about kind of this dog that didn't bark, and that they look at Congress and the ability to limit the president's foreign policy powers, and they say generally what happens when it's a president of a different party, they're not going to bother debating the issues because they know they won't be successful. They won't get involved in foreign policy.
And I think the literature on bureaucracies kind of attests to this point that there tends to be low clarity, just because they are very resistant to change. And the kind of the impetus to maintain that internal bureaucracy. Posen's book on the sources of military doctrine dives into kind of the organizational theory aspect of this, where those aspects of bureaucracy are really rather explored.
Yeah, and I think that kind of... So Posen's book is really interesting, right? Because he writes it while under the tutelage of Ken Waltz, who doesn't believe any of this is possible, but this idea of organizational theory and bureaucracy is growing because Graham Allison writes this book about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And It does, though. I think that they get to a point that when bureaucracies are insulated to make foreign policy, it affects the politicians, and the politicians then can kind of make policy the way they see fit.
Yeah, yeah. And I think particularly with, like, military-industrial complexes and the military bureaucracies, that grows even more with these crises that tend to hold people's attention. They tend to be wars and things that involve violence and therefore involve military structures which are naturally insulated from the public.
I mean, would you say this is where Russia is right now?
With low clarity, definitely. I think some issues have high salience. I think with Crimea and a lot of things in Ukraine, the public has shifted from more of a security angle to an economic one for that. But the government is definitely keen on pushing a certain narrative with regards to the conflicts that they fight abroad in Syria in particular, and kind of pushing a more positive look to that. But it's very easy to attribute success to Putin. It's very hard to punish Putin if something goes wrong.
Right.
And so it's kind of, again, it doesn't quite fit with this framework because, like, theoretically that would be a high clarity type situation because there's such the power vertical in Russian policy and politics that it should focus with Putin. But oftentimes if something goes wrong, he won't be blamed, or if it'll be blamed on the government writ large, or other economic policy aspects of the government.
So I guess my question, though, to kind of defend Narang and Stanlin here a bit, is that even though it isn't punishing Putin directly, it is punishing the people who implemented this foreign policy strategy.
Yeah, and perhaps, like, you know, the relatively low polling numbers for approval of the Russian government could be indicative of something like this, where that's where they can punish. Or with regards to, like, voter turnout, like, if people in such regimes can't vote against the regime, they just won't turn out, and that in turn makes the regime look bad or less legitimate.
Yeah, and so I want to talk about Russia and Syria in a second, but why don't you give the fourth world.
The fourth one is sclerosis, where there's low salience and low clarity. And in this one, there's an insulated security establishment controlled by unelective officials. And there's no democratic advantage to negotiating here, which they typically, they argue that, at least according to the literature, democracies should have advantages when they are negotiating.
Yeah, that's the fear. They talk about fear on there, kind of does. And there's a lot of literature on this, on the democratic war theory, which is that democracies, because they are responsible to a broader group of the public, of their individuals, the stakes are usually higher, and generally they are more successful and have the ability to do things like take out loans with the guarantee of being repaid.
But they also have a popular mandate that they can be called on. So when negotiating, they can legitimately make claims to domestic constraints easier than authoritarian regimes.
Well, right. And so Alistair Smith talks about the converse of that is that voters punish leaders who do not carry out those kind of threats.
Mm-hmm. Although, then again, Jessica Weiss has an interesting piece from a few years ago, I think, on authoritarian signaling, mass audiences, and nationalist protests in China, where these authoritarian regimes can use popular protests in order to demonstrate either domestic constraints or repress them to show their commitment to these international agreements. And in that way, authoritarian regimes can gain a similar type of commitment to the...
Yeah, I mean, it's a different type of signaling, right?
Yeah.
So, Fearon, and he has this classic article about signaling, and he says there's kind of two main types of signaling. You could tie your hands or argue sunk costs. And that most foreign policy decisions, when you're signaling to an ally that you'll defend the ally, are done in that way. Or when you're signaling an adversary, they're done in that way. And you see this with North Korea, right? I mean, the signaling very clearly is putting 30,000 Americans on the DMZ line.
Yeah.
But I think what's interesting about Jessica Weiss is she inverts it and says, okay, well, Fearon's right, but authoritarian states have this ability to signal that other states don't. And it's because if they're worried about their own regime stability and they're concerned about it, odds are they're not going to let the protest happen.
Yeah.
But, if they want the world to think they feel stable, they will let the protest happen as a way to signal to the rest of the world that we're not close to falling.
Or even then, not just with having those protests take place showing the viability of the regime, but when they take place, it shows to the rest of the world that the agreement needs to change because their public is mobilized to such an extent that they are either choosing or cannot repress it. And in order to maintain power, they need to have a different agreement that's more in line with their interests.
Yeah. And so to kind of bring it back to Nerang and Staniland, I feel like they're responding to all of this. There's this type of regime that's beyond all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think this one is definitely one of the most damaging, I think, in the long term to a country, especially with foreign policy. I think in this case, you will see a lot of neglect towards foreign policy and a lot of insular and kind of like the hyper bureaucratization that Posen was kind of talking about, only to a much greater extreme in this fourth kind of framework.
So I think his case study, or their case study here, is really cool, or case studies, because mm-hmm. they look at defense acquisitions in Pakistan and China.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a really cool case because they basically show public doesn't care. The public literally is not affected, but or don't see the effectiveness, don't care about the effectiveness. And they don't care who's responsible.
But for military effectiveness, this is probably the most important thing the public could be caring about. And I think across regimes and across states, we don't see them caring about acquisitions.
Yeah, and I think this is kind of an interesting case that applies cross-country and has immense external validity
mm-hmm.
and is an interesting theoretical way to frame things such as arms trades.
Yeah, agreed.
So what's the big takeaway here? What do Nerang and Staniland say that impacts how we as scholars and students of international security understand the international system?
Well, I think it's just that, you know, salience and clarity can vary over time, and maybe necessarily democracies don't have this advantage when they're crisis bargaining and with other states, and that it's important to pay attention to what the salience and clarity is for a country and how that impacts how they're going to behave and what the domestic public can expect.
Yeah, and I just think the typology is a really interesting way to think about mm-hmm. it, because we talk about regime type, and they talk about this in the article, is that there's not really just this way that people have identified various regime types as typologies and how they affect foreign policy. And I think this is really kind of a great stab at doing that.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I really like the typology. I think it works rather well, like whether or not it has external validity or not. It's a good way to think about this.
Well, and I think future research should test its external validity.
Yeah.
And I'm sure in some cases they'll find that it has it,
mm-hmm.
and others they won't. And I'll be really interested in the variation, what causes that.
Yeah.
So should we move to the next article?
Do you want to jump back and talk about how they measure clarity real quick?
Yeah, let's do it on that note. Let's
yeah,
do it.
On that note. In this article, they say that they have they haven't used policy or polity scales for measuring clarity because it doesn't capture the realities of democratic practice. And measuring the concept, they argue, requires an ex-ante determination of whether voters can both identify and punish individual or individuals responsible for or security policy. And they, when both identification and punishment are possible, they coded clarity of responsibility as high. But I wonder if this isn't necessarily a strict binary between the two, and whether or not you can determine before crises occur whether or not people can punish their politicians or reward them for doing certain things. And I think that comes down almost to like institutions and how they're used. They boil it down to whether or not India at the time had coalition governments or not. Is that kind of diffused responsibility? Or whether or not they were more central under a prime minister and a single party holding a majority. But I think in a lot of cases, there might be less variation with clarity over time, and it is due to some institution how those are used.
Yeah, and so this kind of gets to a problem in political science and international relations research and comparative politics research that is kind of the soft underbelly, which is that we don't really have great measurements for various types of democracies.
Yeah, yeah. There's a couple that you know, varying degree. They measure different things between Polity 4 and Freedom House and VDEM.
Well, Freedom. I mean, Freedom House is no longer really used to the degree it once was because it's Freedom House is pop political science.
Yeah, but I think Polity 4 is still widely used, and some of their measures are particularly helpful. Their durability index is usually pretty good as a variable, and I think it's used in a lot of studies. VDEM, I don't see being used quite as much. Although they treat a lot of things disaggregated instead of aggregated.
Yeah, so VDEM is now being used more in the Democratic Peace research. So Altman has an article from 2016 that basically applies VDEM. And VDEM's nice because it's scalar. So it takes these kind of seven main components of democracy. And with those seven main components, basically makes the argument that each one of these is scalar, and then we kind of combine them together, and what we find is that here's a measure of democracy that, again, is scalar. So there's not just one type of democracy and one type of authoritarianism. There's various types.
But none of these are really measuring that clarity aspect that Narang and Staniland are really going after.
Right, and if it did, Narang and Staniland would have used it.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a variety of like ease with operating between the different ones, and they tend to rank countries differently depending on how they measure. So there's some debate going on between them, I think.
Yeah, and there's some cool research that will test both. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool when you have Polity and VDEM agreeing on something.
Yeah.
But it's kind of just a way to robustness test here. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, future research, it would be really cool if somebody could say, well, let's operationalize clarity. Yeah. Let's figure out three or four different factors that make up clarity.
Yeah, yeah.
And then run a few different regressions with it.
Or even, like, adding it to one of these other measures, I think it would definitely improve whether or not they're capturing what democracy is. Because I think holding your politicians accountable is a key feature of democracy that's often lost.
Yeah, and I think Staniland and Narang may agree. They agree it's key. There's just, we haven't figured out a way to measure it.
Yeah.
And each way you could think about measuring it, especially ex post, is problematic.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to look at that ex ante, and we don't have that.
I think it changes how the theory can be applied, too, if you can determine clarity prior to a situation being undertaken. I think that enhances the theory.
Yep, I agree. All right, so with that said, how about we move to article number two?
Sounds great.
So article number two is Amy Pond's new article in Comparative Political Studies, Financial Liberalization, Stable Autocracies, and Constrained Democracies. So Pond makes this argument that throughout political science, we see this idea that financial liberalization is despised by authoritarian regimes. They don't like it. And the argument goes, they don't like it because it doesn't benefit them. The benefits are dispersed. Autocrats benefit from these kind of centralized preferences. And with the centralized preferences, there's reduced competition and channels to gain these economic benefits, which strengthens the authoritarian regimes. And Pond does a great, well, actually argument and says that autocrats actually can use financial liberalization to strengthen their own position in the regime. And she says it does this in two ways. So first, if financial liberalization can bolster the economy, it makes revolutions less attractive because people benefit. And she preempts a response here because the obvious response is, well, okay, but what about the cases where revolution does happen even after 10 years of financial liberalization, like in Syria? And so kind of in the game that she plays, and I'll get there in a bit, she defines it as three types of regimes. So you have, two types of autocracies, three types of regimes. The first is a stable autocracy. And this is kind of what she's getting at here.
Yeah.
And that's how she preempts it. Because stable autocracies don't have revolutions. And in those autocracies, that's when financial liberalization is done to benefit the regime.
And that's definitely a case that, like, a type of formulation that helps her case, because you wouldn't expect to see financial liberalization in a stable autocracy.
Right, right. And I think she does actually some cool cases where she examines that in Cuba and in Indonesia. But the second kind of argument she makes is that additionally, autocrats can use liberalization to make their assets more mobile. So if they need to change the selectorate, the people that are keeping them in power, financial liberalization lets them do that. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was the most unique part to the argument, because it basically means that elite asset owners with external investment options will become stronger and then can limit redistribution.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting angle to take.
But I also think, like, that can backfire a lot. Like, making those assets more mobile, it doesn't necessarily guarantee regime survival.
No, of course not. And she not once in the paper, and this is very purposeful, says that all autocratic regimes do this, or even that autocratic regimes do it most of the time. She says autocratic regimes can liberalize financially, mm-hmm. can become part of the world system, is a way to attempt to strengthen their mm-hmm. autocracy. And I found that to be a refreshing argument, because we're seeing a lot of this research lately on authoritarian regimes that says they're doing things you wouldn't expect.
Yeah.
And she really hits on this. So she plays this game. She does this game theory. And she has, there's two actors. This world, you have two actors. You have the poor and you have the elite. And the poor and the elite are spread across three different regimes. Autocracies, revolutionary states, and democracies. Mm-hmm.
Quick question. What are your thoughts on her conflating economic and political elites to simplify the model?
I think it's one of those things that makes the game playable.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had too many actors in each world, you're going to get too much variation. And, right, I mean, this is the constant critique of game theory, is that it oversimplifies what we're seeing in the international arena. But I think that that's a different angle. And when you include that, a lot of times you're going to see that authoritarian regimes are, at least politically, would much rather have it centralized, because you don't want various politics. But I really think her focus is on the economic elites.
Yeah, definitely.
So, all right, so we have these two actors in these three different worlds. And she finds two different equilibrium outcomes for democracies. You have a constrained democracy where elites open the capital market to maintain their wealth and protect their wealth, and you have unconstrained democracies where elites' first payoff period they want to maximize because the markets aren't liberalized. That's really unimportant to her argument. Her argument gets interesting when she starts talking about stable autocracies, and she says in these autocracies, elites will use these transfers that they make from the liberalized market to prevent the poor from mobilizing for revolution, and thus democracy is never reached. But then you also have your revolutionary autocracies, where elites, recognizing revolution is going to happen, liberalize financially just to maintain their assets. And those are kind of the, again, the examples of the two causal mechanisms she gets at. So causal mechanism one is that elites can use financial liberalization to prevent the poor from mobilizing and to maintain their assets by just expanding worldwide and increasing their income, or that they use this liberalization to protect their assets themselves.
I think the protection of assets as you're transitioning into a democracy is a fascinating argument that I wish she almost spent more time on in the article, because I feel like that one's, like, both arguments I think are rather novel and very interesting, but the protection of assets moving into a democracy, I think, is particularly interesting, especially if they're able to maintain power within a democracy afterwards.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting because it just has this massive explanatory power. So you have this whole revolutions literature, and there's different waves of this revolution literature, and it basically asks a variety of questions about how do revolutions happen? How do elites react to revolutions? What happens in revolutions where elites are kicked out? Are elites kicked out?
Mm.
And I think that last point is where Pond's situating her argument.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah, revolutions can happen and elites face threats from these revolutions. And they'll actually accept this financial liberalization because it serves as a way for them to protect their assets in countries abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're actually seeing something similar to this in Syria, where Bashar al-Assad's cousin, Rami Makhrouf, left Syria when the revolution started. He also maintains a large number of Syria's private tradable assets are in his possession. And there's a lot of talk that when this kind of all ends, whenever that is, he's going to come back in mm-hmm. with the same amount of assets with a lot more power.
Yeah, that would make sense.
So I think it's an interesting argument. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I think it kind of fits into a broader set of the literature that talks about how there's this trend among authoritarian regimes co-opting democratic institutions for their own survival, or in order to benefit themselves in the case of democratization, where in the past maybe there was a strict binary between dictatorships and democracy, and you move from dictatorships into democracy kind of along this linear path. Oftentimes you can see dictatorships kind of co-opting those institutions. And I think in particular, financial liberalization, I think, falls into that category, and elections definitely do. You see a lot of authoritarian regimes holding elections now where there isn't much competition, but the fact people can use turnout as a way to signal their support or dislike of the regime, even if they can't actually vote for somebody else. And this is the main focus of elections in the Arab world. Why do citizens turn out? By Carolina de Miguel Almani, Jamal, and Mark Tesler from 2015.
Yeah, and Timothy Fry also has this article in, I think, the 2014 issue of World Politics, where he talks about how in Russia you have the government basically using economic coercion, not in a bad way, but basically by saying, we will pay you, business owner, if you get your citizens out to the polls to vote. Or to the citizens, we'll make your work life better if you come out to the polls. And Jason Brownlee has a whole book on this called Authoritarianism in the Age of Democratization, where he talks about elections and he looks at these cases and basically just shows over and over again that authoritarian regimes use elections is this way of maintaining power and of actually kind of increasing their ability to maintain authoritarianism.
And I think one potential angle between political and economic elites that perhaps would benefit upon studies in Russia, once again, you see the economic elite unable to assume political positions, but their economic longevity is highly dependent upon whether or not they offer support to the regime. And if they go against that, then they tend to be forced out of the country, or they lose their economic assets. It's kind of like where Hodorkovsky's case with Lukashenko comes in.
And I think that there is a lot. This article is a theory article. At its core, she does case studies, but at its core, this is a theory article.
And I think the cases are more so examples. I think they could be a little bit better organized. I would like to see why she selected these particular cases to kind of test the theory.
Yeah, and so I do think there's some cool theory testing you can do down the road, or that can be done down the road. And so I guess overall, we've talked about Narang and Stanilan's article. We've talked about Pond, and then more specifically with Pond, this idea of authoritarian regimes do these things to maintain power. Financial liberalization is very much an international issue. It's opening world markets. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my question with all of this is, are the old school neorealists right? Are the or do domestic politics actually have significant importance to foreign policy? And I'm sure the answer is somewhere in between. But
obviously, all these answers wind up being somewhere in between, it seems like, which just makes them harder to answer. But I think especially with globalized markets and kind of the interconnectedness we see today, and even in the past, what you do domestically impacts your international capabilities, and I don't think that can be denied.
Right, and that's kind of the neoclassical realist argument, just to go kind of all theory nerds out, but yeah, and that's really what you're seeing here. And the interesting thing about financial liberalization is I'm actually wondering if it's an example of the international system dictating domestic politics.
I mean, it could be. I think she mentions, like, there's usually WTO and IMF agreements with these countries that try to attempt financial liberalization. IMF in particular plays a very large role in most countries choosing to financially liberalize.
Yeah. So, and Narang and Stanilan are kind of going at an opposite angle, which is they're saying, here are these four different types of domestic politics, and here's how in each of these four types it actually impacts foreign relations.
Yeah, and I think that kind of goes against the realist framework, assuming that all states will behave the same in any given crisis.
At least the old school,
Oh, old school realist, of course. I think more so in a neo-realist camp, but I think the idea that domestic institutions can change over time, and sometimes the state won't act in its best interest in international politics due to domestic constraints.
Yeah, and it's definitely, I mean, Narang and Stanilan very clearly are saying states are not black boxes.
Yeah.
And that variations at the domestic level lead to these variations mm-hmm. at the foreign policy level.
Yeah.
And there's some cool new research that kind of gets at this, especially at least, so I study oil, and at the level of kind of oil and energy politics, there's a ton of research. So Jeff Colgan and Kim and Woods have all written these articles about how variations, how oil acts at the domestic mm-hmm. level affects what happens with these states' foreign policy and war.
Yeah.
And so I think it's going to be really interesting to look at, especially with the Pond article. We're seeing kind of a new birth of these authoritarian regimes.
Yeah.
And to see what they do to maintain power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think it'll be a thing to watch as things develop. But, you know, all of these co-opting of democratic regimes, their job is to improve the longevity of them. And I think it, first off, makes it harder to distinguish between democracies and dictatorships at a first glance, and also makes these dictatorships last longer, and kind of going against, like, Huntington's third wave of democratization.
The new wave, yeah. And so, yeah, I agree. So I think we've kind of reached our time for this podcast. And
point.
So, yeah, exactly. And so I'd just like to say to close out here that if anybody listening, all four of you at this point, have any suggestions of articles or news topics we should talk about on the next show, or even more specific or broadly, theory. What type of theory? We talked about domestic politics and IR today. Any theoretical conversations, let us know, and we'll be sure to discuss them.
We've got comps coming up. We have to read everything anyway.
Yep. All right. Well, with that, thank you, Courtney. This has been fun, and I'll see you next time.
Yep.